Wilf seemed to disappear. By the time the group reconvened, a young widower, whose wife had died of cancer, was sitting beside Harold. The man explained he wished to accompany them, and that in order to gather further public support for Queenie, he would like to do it in a gorilla suit. Before Harold could dissuade him, Wilf reappeared, although he seemed to have difficulty negotiating his passage along the pavement.
"Jesus wept," said Rich.
They made their way slowly. Twice Wilf fell. It also transpired that the gorilla man could only be fed through a straw, and was prone to waves of grief accelerated by heat exhaustion. After half a mile, Harold suggested they should stop for the night. He lit the campfire and reminded himself it had taken at least a few days to find his own rhythm. It would be unkind to abandon them, when they had sought him out and made such a commitment to Queenie. He even wondered if her chances of survival would be greater, the more people there were who believed in her and kept walking. From this point, others joined. They came for a day, maybe two. If it was sunny, there could be a crowd. Campaigners, ramblers, families, dropouts, tourists, musicians. There were banners, campfires, debates, physical warm-ups and music. People talked movingly about the loved ones they had lost to cancer, and also the things they regretted from their past. The greater the numbers, the slower they became. Not only must they accommodate the less experienced walkers, but they must also feed them. There were roast potatoes, garlic on sticks, beetroot in foil. Rich had a book about natural foraging and insisted on making hogweed fritters. The daily mileage dropped further. Sometimes it was no more than three. Despite its slowness, the group seemed sure of itself in a way that was new to Harold. They told themselves they were no longer an assortment of torsos and feet and heads and hearts, but one single energy, bound by Queenie Hennessy. The walk had been an idea inside himself for so long that when other people pledged their belief in it, he was touched. More. He knew it could work. If he had known before, he knew it now in a deeper way. They put up tents, unrolled sleeping bags, and slept beneath the sky. They promised Queenie would live. To their left curved the dark peaks of Keithley Moor. Within only a few days, however, tensions began to develop. Kate had no time for Rich. He was an egomaniac, she said. In return, he called her a bitter cow. Then, during the course of one evening, both the gorilla man and a visiting student slept with the same primary school teacher, and Rich's attempts to resolve the animosity threatened to end in a punch-up. Wilf could not stop trying to convert fellow walkers to God or asking for prayers to be said for Queenie, and this led to further aggravation. When an amateur walking group pitched up for the night, there were more disagreements. Some argued that tents were not in the true spirit of Harold's journey. Some wanted to avoid roads altogether and head towards the more challenging Pennine Way. "And what about roadkill?" asked Rich, sparking off another round. Harold listened with growing unease. He didn't mind where people slept or how they walked. He didn't mind what they ate. He simply wanted to get to Berwick. He was in it now with these other people. After all, they had suffered too in different ways. Wilf still got the shakes at night, and Kate often sat by the fire with tears shining on her cheeks. Even Rich, when he spoke of his boys, had to flap open a handkerchief and pretend he had hay fever. No matter how much he regretted their decisions to join him, it was not in Harold's nature to let his companions down. Sometimes he broke free and washed himself with water or took lungfuls of air. He reminded himself there were no rules to his walk. He had been guilty once or twice of believing he understood, only to discover he did not. Maybe it was the same with the pilgrims. Maybe they were the next part of the journey. There were times, he saw, when not knowing was the biggest truth. and you had to stay with that.
News about the pilgrimage continued to gather momentum, as if it had acquired an energy of its own. Word had only to get round that they were approaching, and everyone with an aga began to bake. Kate narrowly missed injury from a woman in a Land Rover, hell-bent on delivering a tray of goat's cheese slices. Rich suggested over the campfire that Harold should begin each meal with a few words about what it meant to be a pilgrim. When Harold declined, Rich offered to speak instead. He wondered if anyone would care to take notes. The gorilla man obliged, although it was difficult to write with a hairy glove, and he had to keep asking Rich to stop. The press also continued to run testimonies to Harold's goodness. He did not have time to read the papers, but it seemed that Rich was more up to date. A spiritualist in Clitheroe claimed the pilgrim had a golden aura. A young man who had been on the verge of jumping from the Clifton suspension bridge gave a moving account of how Harold had talked him down. "But I didn't go to Bristol," Harold said. "I went to Bath, and from there to Stroud. I remember it clearly because it was the point when I almost gave up. I never met anyone on a bridge, and I am certain I didn't talk them down." Rich claimed this was a minor detail, petty in fact. "Maybe he didn't say he was about to commit suicide, but meeting you gave him hope. I expect you've forgotten." Again he reminded Harold that he had to look at the bigger picture. No publicity was bad publicity. It occurred to Harold that even though Rich was 40, and therefore about the right age to be his son, he talked as if it was Harold who was the child. He said that Harold was cornering a rich market. You had to strike while the iron was hot. He also mentioned cherry-picking ideas and singing from the same hymn sheet. But Harold was getting a headache. He had such a congestion of incoherent images in his mind, cherry trees and hymn sheets and steam irons, that he had to keep stopping in order to work out what exactly it was that Rich was talking about. He wished the man would honour the true meaning of words, instead of using them as ammunition. It was already mid-June, and Wilf's estranged father gave a moving interview about the courage of his son.
"He's never even met me," said Wilf.
The Council of Berwick-upon-Tweed commissioned placards and bunting to welcome the pilgrim's arrival. The owner of a corner shop in Ripon accused them of stealing several items, including whiskey. Rich called a meeting, during which, in no uncertain terms, he accused Wilf of theft and suggested he should be sent home. For once, Harold stood up and disagreed. But it pained him to be put in a place of confrontation, and he saw he could not do it again. Rich listened with his eyes narrowed into slits so that Harold lost words mid-sentence. Rich finally conceded that Wilf should be given another chance, but he avoided Harold for the rest of the afternoon. Then half the group went down with stomach cramps and temperatures when the boy mistook some mildly poisonous mushrooms for the friendly ones that looked disarmingly similar. Just as they were recovering, the abundance of red currants, cherries, and raw gooseberries in their diet brought on a compromising spate of diarrhea. The gorilla man was badly stung while taking notes for Rich when it transpired there was a wasp in his glove. For 2 days they did not walk at all. The horizon was a series of blue peaks that Harold longed to climb. The sun hung high in the eastern sky, leaving the moon so pale it looked made of cloud. If only these people would go, would find something else to believe in. He shook his head, berating himself for his disloyalty. Rich informed the group that something was needed to distinguish the real pilgrims from their followers. He had the solution. He had been in touch with an old friend in PR who owed him a favour. The friend in turn had contacted the distributors of a health drink, and they would be delighted to provide all official walkers with T-shirts with the word pilgrim on the front and back. The T-shirts would be available in white and come in 3 sizes.
White?
Kate scoffed.
Where are we going to wash these things?
White stands out, said Rich, and its image is pure. There speaks a man, and bollocks, said Kate. The company would also provide a limitless supply of healthy fruit drinks. All they wanted in return was for Harold to be seen holding one as often as possible. As soon as the T-shirts arrived, a press call was organized. Harold was to be joined on the A617 by Miss South Devon for the photo shoot. Harold said,
I think the others should be in it too. They have made a commitment to the walk as well as me.
Rich said that clouded the message about faith for the 21st century, and also weakened the Queenie love story.
But I was never trying to make a point about those things, said Harold. And I love my wife.
Rich handed him a fruit drink and reminded him to hold the bottle with the label facing towards the camera.
I'm not asking you to finish it. I just want you to hold the thing. And did I say you've been invited to dinner with the mayor?
I'm honestly not very hungry.
You need to take the dog. His wife has something to do with the Blue Cross.
It seemed that people were taking offence if the pilgrims did not visit their town. The mayor of a resort in North Devon gave an interview claiming Harold was white middle-class elitist. And Harold was so shaken, he felt the need to apologize. He even wondered if he'd have to walk home, taking in all the places he had failed to pass en route to Berwick. He admitted to Kate the fruit drinks were playing havoc with his digestive system.
But Rich told you, he said, you don't have to drink them. You can throw it away as soon as the photo's taken.
He smiled sadly.
I can't hold the bottle and remove the lid and then not drink it. I'm a post-war child, Kate. We don't talk up our achievements and we don't throw things away. It's how we were brought up.
Kate reached up her arms and gave him a damp hug. He wanted to return it, but he stood rather helpless in her embrace. Maybe that was another symptom of his generation. Certainly he looked at the people around him in their vest tops and their shorts and wondered if he had become superfluous.
What's troubling you? She said. You keep wandering off.
Harold straightened himself.
I can't help feeling this is wrong. All the noise, all the fuss. I appreciate how much everyone has done, but I don't see any more how it's going to help Queenie. We only covered 6 miles yesterday, and 7 the day before that. I wonder if I should go.
Kate swung round very suddenly, as if she had received some sort of blow to her chin.
Go?
Get back on the road.
Without us, she said.
There was panic in her eyes.
You can't leave us, not now.
Harold nodded.
Promise me.
She gripped his arm. The gold of her wedding ring caught the sunlight.
Of course I won't go without you.
They walked on in silence. He wished he had not mentioned his doubts. It was clear she had no room for them. Yet despite his promise, Harold remained troubled. He had good periods of walking, but with illness and injury and so much public support, it took almost 2 weeks to cover 60 miles. They were not yet in Darlington. He imagined Maureen seeing pictures of him in the newspapers, and he was ashamed. He wondered what she thought when she saw them, if she thought him a fool. One night, as supporters and well-wishers took out guitars and began to sing by the fire, Harold fetched his rucksack and slipped away. The sky was so clear and black, it throbbed with stars, and the moon was losing its fullness once more. He thought back to the night he had slept in the barn near Stroud. No one knew the real truth about why he was walking to Queenie. They had made assumptions. They thought it was a love story, or a miracle, or an act of beauty, or even bravery. But it was none of those things. The discrepancy between what he knew and what other people believed frightened him. It also made him feel, as he looked back at the camp, that even in the midst of them he was unknown. The fire was a glow of light in the blackness, Voices and laughter came to him, and they were all strangers. He could keep walking. There was nothing to stop him. Yes, he had made a promise to Kate, but his loyalty to Queenie was greater. After all, he had everything he needed, his shoes, the compass, Queenie's gifts. He could take a more indirect route, across the hills perhaps, and avoid people altogether. His pulse quickened as his feet drove forwards. He could walk the nights, the dawns again. He could be in Berwick in weeks. Then he heard Kate's voice, thin against the night air, calling his name, and the dog barking at her feet. He heard other voices, some he recognized, some he didn't, all shouting, "Harold," into the darkness. His loyalty to them was not the same as his loyalty to Queenie, but they deserved more than to be abandoned without so much as an explanation. Slowly he returned. Rich emerged out of the shadows just as Harold hit the circle of soft light from the fire. Spotting the old man, he ran towards him and bundled Harold into his arms.
"We thought you'd gone."
His voice shook. He had maybe been drinking. It was certainly the smell of it. Rich clung so hard that Harold lost his balance and almost fell.
"Steady on there,"
laughed Rich. It was a rare moment of affection, albeit a little stumbling. But locked in this embrace, Harold struggled for breath as if he were being slowly suffocated. A photograph appeared next day in the papers, with the caption, "Can Harold Fry make it?" He appeared to be collapsing into Rich's arms. Chapter 23 Maureen and Harold. Maureen could bear it no longer. She confided in Rex that against David's advice she was going to find Harold. She had spoken with her husband on the phone. He hoped the pilgrims would reach Darlington by the following afternoon. She knew it was too late to make amends for the past, but she would have one last stab at persuading him to come home. As soon as it was light, she fetched the car keys from the hall table and slipped a coral lipstick into her handbag. Locking the front door, she was surprised to hear Rex call her name. He was wearing a sun hat, a pair of shades, and he was clutching a hardback road map of the British Isles.
"I thought you might need someone to navigate," he said. "According to the AA, we shall be there by late afternoon."
The miles sped past, but she barely saw them. She said things while knowing that none of them added up, as if she were saying words that were only the tip of the huge mountain of feeling beneath. What if Harold didn't want to see her? What if the other pilgrims were with him?
"Supposing you're wrong, Rex," she said. "Supposing he is in love with Queenie after all. Maybe I should write. What do you think? I feel I might say it better in a letter."
When he said nothing, she turned to Rex and found him looking peaky.
"Are you all right?"
He gave a tight nod, as if he were afraid of moving.
"You have overtaken 3 articulated lorries and a coach," he said, "in single-lane traffic."
He added that he thought he would be fine if he sat very still and looked out of the window. It was easy to find Harold and the pilgrims. Someone had arranged a photo shoot for the tourist board in a pedestrianized market square, and Maureen joined a small crowd. There was a tall man ushering photographers, and also a gorilla who appeared to need a chair, as well as a stout woman eating a sandwich, and a young man looking shifty. Catching sight of Harold, as if she were no more than a stranger, Maureen was disarmed. She had seen him on the local news, and she kept the newspaper clippings in her handbag, but none of it had prepared her for seeing him in true life, as David used to say. Harold surely couldn't have grown taller or broader, but looking at this weather-beaten pirate of a man, with his skin like dark leather and his curling hair, she felt she had become both one-dimensional and more fragile. It was the pared-down vitality of him that made her tremble, as if he had at last become the man he should have been all along. His pilgrim T-shirt was stained and frayed at the neck. The colour was gone from his yachting shoes, and the shape of his feet was practically through the leather. Harold caught Maureen's eye and stopped short. He said something to the tall man and broke free. As Harold walked towards her, he laughed so openly, she had to look away, unable to meet the fullness of his smile. She didn't know whether to offer him her lips or her cheek, and at the last moment she changed her mind, so that he kissed her nose instead and prickled her face with his beard. People were watching. "Hello, Maureen." His voice was deep and assured. She felt her knees weaken. "What brings you all the way to Darlington?" "Oh," she shrugged. "Rex and I fancied a drive." He looked around, his face beaming. "Goodness! Has he come too?"
"He's gone to W.H. Smith's. He needed paper clips. After that, he was keen to visit the Railway Museum. You can see the locomotion."
He was standing right over her, gazing into her face, and not looking away. It was like being under lights. "It's a steam train," she added, because he still didn't seem to be doing anything, just smiling. She couldn't stop staring at his mouth. Despite the beard, his jaw had lost its rigid set. His lips looked soft. An old fellow shouted into a megaphone to the crowd,
"Shop all you can! This is the word of the Lord. Shopping is what gives our lives purpose. Jesus came on earth to shop."
He had no shoes. It broke the ice. Harold and Maureen smiled, and she felt there was a conspiracy between them, as if they were the only people in the world who saw it right. "People," she shook her head knowingly. "It takes all sorts," said Harold. There was nothing condescending about his remark, nor was there anything reprimanding. It was more generous than anything else, as if the strangeness of other people was a marvellous thing. But it made her feel overwhelmingly parochial. She said,
"Do you have time for a cuppa?"
She never normally referred to a pot of Earl Grey as a cuppa, and fancy trying to make up for your plain Englishness by suggesting tea. "I would love that, Maureen," said Harold. They chose a coffee outlet on the ground floor of a department store, because she said you could always trust the things you knew. The girl behind the counter stared as if she was trying to place him, and Maureen felt both proud and in the way. She had put on a pair of brand new trainers at the last minute, and they shone on the ends of her legs like beacons.
"So much choice," said Harold, gazing at the muffins and cakes, each one in its own paper case. "Are you sure you don't mind paying, Maureen?"
More than anything, she wanted to stare. It was years since she had seen those blue eyes look so vibrant. He rubbed the curls of his giant beard between his forefinger and thumb, so that they stuck out in peaks like royal icing. She wondered if the girl behind the counter realized she was Harold's wife.
"What will you have?" she said.
She wanted to add darling, but the word was too shy to come out. He asked if he might have a slice of Mars bar tray bake with a strawberry frappe. Maureen gave a shrill laugh that sounded as if she had just emptied it out of a packet. "And I'll have tea, please," she told the girl behind the counter. "Milk, no sugar." Harold shone his benign smile in the direction of the girl, whose name was pinned on her black T-shirt just above her left bosom. To Maureen's amazement, the young woman flushed from her neck upwards and grinned back.
"You're that guy off the news," she said. "The pilgrim. My mates think you're awesome. Would you mind signing this?"
She held out her arm and a felt-tip pen. And Maureen was astonished a second time to witness Harold inscribing his name with indelible ink on the soft flesh above the girl's wrist. "Best wishes, Harold." He didn't even flinch. The girl cradled her arm and stared long and hard at it. Then she set the drinks and the Mars bar cake on a tray, along with one extra scone.
"Have this on me," she said.
Maureen had never seen anything like it. She let Harold lead the way, and it was as if the room opened and hushed to make space for him. She noticed the other customers staring hard at Harold and saying things behind cupped hands. At a table in the corner, three ladies of her own age were drinking tea. She wondered where their husbands were, if they were playing golf, or dead, maybe, or if they had walked out on their wives as well. "Afternoon," he said brightly, greeting complete strangers. He chose a table beside the window so that he could keep an eye on the dog. It lay on the pavement outside, chewing on a stone, as if very interested in the business of waiting. She felt a swell of kinship with the animal. Maureen and Harold sat opposite each other, not side by side. And even though she had drunk tea with him for 47 years, her hands shook as she poured. Harold's cheeks hollowed as his frappe shot up through a straw and entered his mouth with a honk. She waited a polite moment for the drink to go down. Only she waited too long, and she opened her mouth to speak at the exact moment he did.
"It's nice to, lovely to—"
They gave a laugh as if they didn't know one another terribly well.
"No, no," he said.
"After you," she said. It was like another collision, and they each retreated back to their drinks. She added milk to her cup, but her hand shook again and the whole lot sloshed out in a rush.
"Do people often recognize you, Harold?"
She sounded like a woman interviewing him for the television.
"What gets me, Maureen, is how nice everyone is."
"Where did you sleep last night?"
"In a field."
She shook her head in awe. But he must have misunderstood, because he said in a rush, "I don't smell, do I?"
"No, no,"
she rushed back.
"I washed in a stream, and then again by a drinking fountain, only I don't have soap."
He had already finished his Mars bar cake and was slicing open the complimentary scone. He ate food so fast he seemed to inhale it. She said,
"I could buy you some soap. I'm sure I passed a body shop."
"Thank you. That's really kind. But I don't want to carry too much." Maureen felt afresh the shame of not getting it. She longed to show him all her colours, and here she was, a suburban shade of grey. "Oh," she said, dipping her head. The pain rose, tightening her throat, making it impossible to speak. His hand passed her a bundled handkerchief, and Maureen nipped her face into its crumpled warmth. It smelt of him, and long ago. It was no good. The tears came.
"It's just seeing you again," she said. "You look so well."
"You look well too, Maureen."
"I don't, Harold. I look like someone left behind."
She wiped her face, but tears were still leaking between her fingers. She was sure the girl at the counter must be looking, and the shoppers, and the ladies without their husbands. Let them. Let them all stare.
"I miss you, Harold. I wish you would come home."
She waited with her blood thumping up and down her veins. At last Harold rubbed his head, as if he had an ache there or something he needed to dislodge.
"You miss me?"
"Yes."
"You wish I would come home?"
She nodded. It was too much to repeat it. Harold scratched his head again and then lifted his gaze to hers. She felt her insides pick up and spring over and over. He said slowly,
"I miss you too. But Maureen, I've spent my life not doing anything. And now at last I am doing something. I have to finish my walk. Queenie is waiting."
She
She believes in me, you see.
Well, yes, she said. I do see that. Of course I see it.
She took a sip of tea. It was cold.
I'm sorry, Harold. I don't see where I fit in. I know you're a pilgrim now and everything, but I can't help thinking about myself. I'm not as selfless as you. I'm sorry.
I'm no better than anyone else. I'm really not. Anybody can do what I'm doing, but you have to let go. I didn't know that at the beginning, but now I do. You have to let go of the things you think you need, like cash cards and phones and maps and things. He looked at her with his eyes shining and his steady smile. She reached again for her tea and remembered as it hit her mouth that it was cold. She wanted to ask if pilgrims travelled without wives as well, but she didn't. She forced another of those jolly faces that seemed to hurt, and then she glanced towards the window where Harold's dog was still waiting. "He's eating a stone," he laughed.
"He does that. You have to be careful not to throw it for him. If you do, he thinks you like throwing stones and he follows you. He doesn't forget." She smiled again. This one didn't hurt.
"Have you given him a name?"
"Just dog. It didn't seem right to give him anything else. He's his own animal sort of thing. I felt a name might sound as if I thought I owned him."
She nodded, all out of words.
"You know," Harold said suddenly, "you could walk with us."
He reached for her fingers, and she let him take them. The palms of his hands were so stained and calloused, and her own were so pale and slight. She couldn't see how these fingers had ever fitted together. Her hand lay in her husband's, and all the rest of her was numb. Moments from their marriage passed through her head, like a series of photographs. She saw him creeping out of the bathroom on their wedding night, the nakedness of his chest so beautiful she had gasped out loud, and caused him to dive straight back into his jacket. There was Harold at the hospital, gazing at his new baby son, and stretching out his finger. She saw, too, all those images in the leather albums that over the years she had cleaned from her memory. They passed through her mind in a flash, recognizable to no one but herself. She sighed. It was all so far away. And there were so many other things lodged now between them. She saw herself and Harold 20 years ago, side by side in their sunglasses, and unable to touch. His voice parted the blanket of her thoughts.
"What do you think? Do you think you might come, Maureen?"
She eased her hand from Harold's and pushed back her chair. "It's too late," she murmured. "I think not." She stood, but Harold didn't, so that she felt she was already out of the door. "There's the garden. And Rex. Besides, I don't have my things."
"You don't need your—"
"I do," she said. He chewed his beard and nodded, but without looking up, as if to say, "I know."
"I'd better get back. Rex says hello, by the way, and I bought you some plasters, as well as one of those fruit drinks you like so much."
She slid them into the neutral spot on the table midway between herself and Harold.
"But maybe pilgrims don't use plasters."
Harold leaned back to slip both her presents into his pocket. His trousers hung loose at his hips. "Thank you, Maureen. They'll come in very handy." "It was selfish of me to ask you to give up your walk. Forgive me, Harold." He sunk his head so low she wondered if he had fallen asleep on the table. She could see down his neck to the soft white skin of his back, where the sun hadn't reached. She felt a shiver shoot straight through her, as if she were seeing him naked for the first time. When he lifted his head and met her eye, she blushed. He spoke so softly,
The words were part of the air. I'm the one who needs forgiveness. Rex was waiting in the passenger seat, with coffee in a polystyrene cup and a doughnut wrapped in a serviette. She sat beside him and took small gulps of air to stop more weeping. He offered her the drink and the food, but she had no appetite.
I even said I think not. I can't believe I said that.
You have a good cry.
Thank you, Rex, but I've cried enough. I'd prefer to stop now.
She dabbed her eyes and glanced out at the street, where people were going about their business. All around her there seemed to be men and women, old ones, young ones, walking apart or together. The coupled world looked so busy, so sure of itself. She said,
"Years ago, when Harold and I first met, he called me Maureen. Then it changed to Maure, and that was how it was for years. These days it's Maureen again."
She touched her mouth with her fingers, pressing for silence.
"Would you like to stay?"
said Rex's voice.
"Talk to him again?"
She twisted the key in the ignition.
"No. Let's go home."
And as they pulled away, she saw Harold, this stranger who had been her husband for so many years, with a dog trotting at his side and a group of followers she didn't know. But she didn't throw a wave or hoot the horn. Without fanfare or ceremony, or even a proper goodbye, she drove away from Harold and let him walk. 2 days later, Maureen woke to a bright sky full of promise and a light breeze that played at the leaves. The perfect washing day. She fetched the stepladder and took down the net curtains. Light, colour and texture fell over the room as if they had been trapped in the space behind the nets all along. The curtains were white and dry within the day. Maureen folded them into bags and took them to the charity shop. Chapter 24 Harold and Rich. Something happened after Harold walked away from Maureen. It was as if a door closed on a part of him that he wasn't sure he preferred to leave open. He no longer took pleasure in imagining the welcoming party of nurses and patients at the hospice. He could no longer visualize the end of his journey. The going was slow and troubled with so much argument that it took the group almost a week to cover the stretch from Darlington to Newcastle. He lent Wilf the willow cane and never got it back. Maureen had said she missed him. She wanted him home. He couldn't get that out of his mind. He found excuses to borrow mobile phones and ring.
"I'm fine," she would say. "I'm good."
She would tell him about a moving letter that had arrived in the post or a small gift. Or maybe she would describe the progress of her runner beans.
"But you don't want to hear about me," she'd add.
He did, though. He wanted that so much.
"On the phone again?" Rich would ask, with a grin but no empathy.
He accused Wilf of stealing again, and privately Harold was afraid he was right. It was painful to keep defending the boy, when he knew in his gut he was as unreliable as David. Wilf didn't even hide his empty bottles. It could take an embarrassingly long time to wake him, and as soon as he was on his feet he complained. Trying to protect him, Harold told the others the old injury on his right leg was playing up. He suggested longer periods of rest. He even suggested they might like to go on ahead. "No, no," they chorused. "Harold was the walk. They couldn't possibly do it without him." For the first time, he felt relief on reaching the towns. Wilf seemed to snap alive again. And seeing other people, looking into shop windows, thinking about what he didn't need, offered Harold distraction from his own doubts about what had happened to his journey. He didn't know how he had created something that had grown beyond his ability to keep hold of it.
A guy offered me a shitload of money for my story, said Wilf, sprinting up beside him.
He had the jitters again and smelt of whiskey.
I said, no, Mr. Fry, I'm sticking with you.
The pilgrims set up camp, but Harold no longer sat with them while they cooked or planned the next day's route. Rich had begun hunting for rabbits and birds, which he skinned or plucked and cooked over the flames. The sight of the poor animal, stripped and skewered, made Harold tremble. Besides, there was a hungry wildness in Rich's eye these days that reminded him of both Napier and his father, and alarmed him. Rich's pilgrim T-shirt was smeared with blood. He had taken to wearing a string of small rodent teeth round his neck. They put Harold off his food. Tired and increasingly empty, he would stroll through the oncoming night while the crickets creaked and stars pricked the sky. This was the only time he felt free and connected. He thought of Maureen and Queenie. He remembered the past. Hours could pass, and they would seem both like days and no time at all. Returning to the group, some already sleeping, some singing by the campfire, he would feel a cold wave of panic. What was he doing with these people? While Harold was out of the way, Rich called a private meeting. He had grave concerns, he said. They were difficult to voice, but someone had to. Queenie couldn't hang on for much longer. In light of this, he suggested that a reconnaissance party, led by himself, should take an alternative cross-country route.
I know this is hard for everyone because we love Harold. He's been a father to me, but the guy is slowing down. His leg's bad. He wanders off for half the night, and now this fasting. He's not the man he was.
He's not fasting, objected Kate. You make it sound religious. He's just not hungry.
Whatever he's doing, he's not up to the journey. You've got to call a spade a spade. We need to think how we can help.
Kate sucked something stringy and green from a back tooth. You do talk crap, she said. Wilf yelped with hysterical laughter, and the subject was dropped. But Rich sat very quietly for the rest of the evening, slightly apart from the group, chipping at a stick with his penknife, splintering it and sharpening it to a piercing point. Harold was woken the following morning by shouts. Rich's knife had gone. After a thorough search of the field, banks and hedgerows, it was clear that Wilf had gone with it. And so, he discovered, had the glittering paperweight for Queenie Hennessy. The Gorilla Man reported news that Pilgrim Wilf had set up a Facebook page. It already had over 1,000 likes. There were personal anecdotes about his walk and the people he had saved. There were several prayers. He promised his fans there were more stories to come in the weekend papers.
I told you he was no good, said Rich across the campfire. His eyes pinned Harold through the dark.
Harold was deeply troubled by the boy's disappearance. He walked apart from the group and scanned the shadows for signs. In towns he stared into pubs and gangs of young men searching for Wilf's gaunt, sickly face, or listening out for that infuriating yelp of a laugh. He felt he had let the boy down, and that this was how it always was with Harold. Once again, he slept badly at nights. And sometimes he did not sleep at all.
"You look tired," said Kate.
They had moved a little distance from the group and were sitting in a brick tunnel by a stream. The water was still and thick, more like green velvet than fluid. Further along the banks there was water mint and cress. But Harold knew he had lost the interest in picking them.
"I feel a long way from where I began. But I also feel a long way from where I'm going."
He gave a yawn that seemed to shudder up through his whole body.
"Why do you think Wilf went?"
"He'd had enough. I don't think he was evil or anything like that. He's young, he's flaky." Harold felt someone was talking to him at last without frills, as in the early days of his walk, when no one had expectations, including himself.
He confided that Wilf had reminded him of his son, and that Harold's betrayal of David sometimes pained him these days even more than his betrayal of Queenie.
When my son was little, we realized he was clever. He spent all his time in his room doing schoolwork. If he didn't get top marks, he'd be in tears. But then his intelligence seemed to backfire on him. He was too clever. Too lonely. He got into Cambridge and he started drinking. I was such a no-hoper at school, I was in awe of his intelligence. Failure was about the only thing I was good at. Kate laughed, and her chin concertinaed into her neck. Despite her brusque manner, he had begun to find comfort in the stalwart bulk of her. She said,
"I never said anything about this to the others, but my wedding ring disappeared a few nights ago, too."
Harold sighed. He knew he had trusted Wilf against the odds. But somehow he had also trusted that there was a basic goodness to be found in everyone, and at this time he could tap into it.
"It doesn't matter about the ring. My ex and I just got divorced. I don't know why I kept on wearing it." She flexed her naked fingers. "So maybe Wilf did me a favour."
"Should I have done more, Kate?"
Kate smiled. "You can't save everyone."
She paused, and then she asked,
"Do you still see your son?"
The question hurt. "No."
"I guess you miss him," she said.
Not since Martina had anyone asked about David. His mouth dried, and his heart began to quicken. He wanted to describe what it feels like to find your boy in a pool of vomit, and carry him to bed and mop him up, and pretend in the morning you have not seen that. He wanted to say what it was like to be a child and find the man who was your father in the same manner. He wanted to say, "What happened? Was it me? Am I the link here?" But he didn't. He didn't want to burden her with so much. He nodded and said yes, he missed David. Gripping his knees, he pictured himself lying in his room as a teenager, listening to the silence that did not hold his mother. He remembered hearing that Queenie had left, and sinking to his chair because she had not said goodbye. He saw Maureen, white with hatred, slamming the spare room door. He relived the last time he had visited his father.
"I'm terribly sorry," the carer had said.
She had Harold by his jacket sleeve, and was almost tugging him out of range.
"But he seems disturbed. Maybe you'd better leave it for today."
Glancing over his shoulder as he hurried away, his final impression had been of a small man throwing teaspoons and yelling he had no son. How could he say all this? It amounted to a lifetime. He could try to find the words, but they would never hold the same meaning for her that they did for him. "My house," he would say, and the image that would spring to her head would be of her own. There was no saying it. Kate and Harold sat a while more in silence. He listened to the wind in the leaves of a willow and watched them flicker. Spikes of rosebay willow herb and evening primrose glowed in the dark. From the campfire came the sounds of laughter and shouts. Rich was organizing a nocturnal game of tag.
"It's getting late," said Kate at last. "You need sleep."
They returned to the others, but sleep did not come. His head was still full of his mother, and trying to capture a memory of her that might bring comfort. He thought of the cold of his childhood home, and the smell of whiskey that was even in his school clothes, and the greatcoat that was his 16th birthday present. For the first time, he allowed himself to feel the pain of being a child that is not wanted by mother or father. He ranged for many hours in the dark, under a sky lit with infinitesimal stars. Images passed through his mind of Joan wetting her finger to turn the page of a travel magazine, or rolling her eyes as his father's hands trembled over a bottle. But nowhere could he find her kissing Harold's head,
or even telling him he would be all right. Had she ever asked herself where he was? How he was doing? He saw the reflection of her face in a compact mirror as she painted on her red lips. She did it with such care, he had felt she was trapping something behind the colour. A wave of emotion swelled through him as he recalled catching her eye once. She had stopped what she was doing so that her mouth was left half Joan and half mother. With his heart beating so hard, it made his voice flutter. He had summoned the courage to speak.
"Please, will you tell me? Am I ugly?"
She had burst out laughing. The dimple in her cheek was so deep, he could imagine slipping his finger into it. It wasn't meant to be funny. It was from the heart. But in the absence of all physical affection, her laughter had been the next best thing. He wished he had not torn her only letter to shreds. "Dear son." It would have been something. It would have been something, too, to hold David in his arms and promise him things get better. He felt nothing but anguish for the things that couldn't be undone. Returning to his sleeping bag before dawn, Harold found a small bundle beneath the zip, containing a heel of bread, an apple, and bottled water. He wiped his eyes and ate the food, but still he didn't sleep. As the profile of Newcastle dominated the horizon, tensions rose yet again. Kate wanted to avoid the city altogether. Someone else had bunions and needed a doctor, or at least first aid. Rich had so many thoughts on the nature of the modern pilgrimage that the gorilla man needed a new notebook. Flummoxing them all, Harold asked the group if they might make a detour via Hexham. He produced from his jacket pocket the business card of the man in the hotel where he had spent his first night. It was creased with time and furry at the edges. But even though those first few days of his walk had almost broken him, he remembered them with envy. They held a simplicity that he felt he was in danger of losing if he had not lost it already.
"Of course, I can't make you come with me," said Harold. "But I will stick to my promise."
A further secret meeting was called by Rich.
"I can't believe I'm the only one who's man enough to say it, but you lot can't see the wood for the trees. The guy's falling apart. We can't go to Hexham. It's over 20 miles in the wrong direction."
"He made a promise," said Kate, "just as he made one to us. He's too polite to renege on that. It's rather English and very endearing,"
Rich flared. "In case you've forgotten, Queenie is dying. I vote we form a splinter group and push straight up to Berwick. He suggested it himself before now. We could be there in a week."
No one expressed an opinion. But in the morning, Kate discovered a lot of campaigning had taken place in the night. Whispered conversations in tents and over the dying embers of the fire had confirmed Rich's opinion. They all loved Harold, but it was time to break free. They looked for the old man, but he was not to be found. They packed up their sleeping bags and tents and were gone. Apart from the smouldering embers of a fire, the field was so empty, she could almost doubt any of it had happened. Kate found Harold sitting by a river, throwing stones for the dog. His shoulders were hunched as if a weight pressed down on him. It shocked her how old he suddenly looked. She told him Rich had persuaded the gorilla man to go ahead, and that they had taken the well-wishers and what was left of the journalists.
He called a meeting and gave some story about you needing a break. He even squeezed out a few tears. "There's nothing I could do, but people won't be fooled for long."
"I don't mind. To tell the truth, it was getting too much."
The swallows were skimming the water, turning vertically on their wings. He watched them a while.
"What will you do next, Harold? Will you go home?"
He shook his head, but it was a heavy gesture.
"I'll make the trip to Hexham, and then I'll head up from there towards Berwick."
Not long now. What about you?
I'm going home. My ex has been in touch. He wants us to have another go at it.
Harold's eyes moistened in the morning light.
That's good, he said.
He reached for her hand and squeezed it. She wondered briefly if he was thinking of his wife. From there, their arms took the opportunity to catch hold of the other's body. Kate didn't know if it was she who was holding on to Harold or the other way round. He was bone inside his pilgrim T-shirt. They remained in an odd half-embrace, a little off balance, until she broke free and wiped her cheeks.
"Please take care of yourself," she said. "I know you are a good man, and that seems to give you away with people, but you look tired. You need to look after yourself, Harold."
He waited as Kate walked away. She turned several times to wave, and he stayed in the same place, letting her go. He had walked too much with other people, and listened to their stories, and followed their routes. It would be a relief to listen again only to himself. All the same, as Kate grew smaller, he felt the wrench of losing her. And it was like a little piece of dying. She reached a break in the trees ahead, and he was about to go when she paused, as if she had lost her way or forgotten something. She began to walk back to him, very fast, almost running, and he felt a shiver of excitement, because of all of them, even Wilf, it was Kate he had grown to love. But then she stopped again, and seemed to shake her head. He knew that for her sake he must keep standing and watching her go, a constant in the distance, until she had left him fully behind. He threw a large wave, two hands beating at the air. She turned her back on him and met the line of trees. He remained a long time, waiting in case she reappeared. But the air was still and did not bring her. Harold removed the pilgrim T-shirt and retrieved his shirt and tie from his rucksack. They were screwed up and very worn now, but it was like being himself again as he put them on. He wondered whether he should take the T-shirt to Queenie as a further souvenir, but it didn't feel right to carry something that had caused such dispute. Instead, he slipped it in a bin when no one was looking. He found he was wearier than he had realized. It took Harold a further 3 days to reach Hexham. He rang at the buzzer of the businessman's apartment and waited all afternoon. But there was no sign of his host. A woman from another flat came down and explained that the businessman was on holiday in Ibiza. "He's always on holiday," she said. She asked if Harold would like tea or water for the dog, but he declined both. A week after the split, reports came of the pilgrims' arrival in Berwick-upon-Tweed. There were photographs in the newspapers of Rich Lyon walking hand in hand with his two sons along the quay, and others of a man in a gorilla suit nuzzling the cheek of Miss South Devon. There was a brass band to welcome the party, with a performance by the local cheerleading troupe, and a dinner attended by local councillors and businessmen. Several Sunday papers claimed to have sole access to Rich's diaries. There was talk of a film. The pilgrim's arrival was also covered on the television news. Courtesy of BBC Spotlight, Maureen and Rex watched footage of Rich Lyon and several others delivering flowers to the hospice along with a giant basket of muffins, although Queenie was unable to receive them. The reporter added that sadly no one from the hospice was available for comment. She stood with her microphone at the edge of the drive. Behind her there appeared to be a neatly kept garden with blue hydrangeas and a man in a boiler suit raking grass clippings.
"Those people don't even know Queenie," said Maureen. "Makes me want to spit. Why couldn't they wait for Harold?"
Rex sipped a cup of Ovaltine.
"I suppose they were impatient to get there."
"But it was never a race. It was the journey that mattered. And that man didn't walk for Queenie."